This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, May 4th, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. The Department of Education doesn't educate children, but it does create expensive compliance problems that states and localities must solve. Vicki Alger, author of Failure, The Federal Miseducation of America's Children, argues that the Department of Education, at best, achieves nothing. We spoke last week. Well, I asked this question to a lot of lawmakers, which is, what is the one area of government that the feds should have absolutely no role in? And almost across the board, Republicans at least jump right to the Department of Education and shutting it down. Why is that such a high priority?
Well, I think it's such a high priority, first and foremost, from a principled stance. This is one of those areas that the federal government clearly has zero constitutional authority. In fact, the word education doesn't even appear once in the U.S. Constitution. But secondly, even if you believe that there is some quote-unquote traditional or historical partnership role between the federal government and the states, let's look at the results. We are spending on par with defense spending as a country, and we've been doing this for decades. And student achievement, particularly among disadvantaged student populations, is still really hasn't changed. Test scores, proficiency rates across the board, grade level, subject areas, socioeconomic groups are essentially flatlined. The only thing that has appreciably changed is that we are spending far, far more. So essentially what we're doing is we are taking all of these resources, putting control in the wrong hands, particularly now when we have an explosion of parental choice programs across the country that are actually working for a whole lot less and put the real experts in charge, which are children's parents.
So you would argue then that, states have been leading the way on this for decades and the feds have done what? Nothing?
I would like to say at best nothing. Recently, it's become more pernicious with the imposition of Common Core. And what's interesting to see is that about 10 years ago, there was a growing recognition that there's federal intrusion in my children's classrooms. And with all the testing and the mandates, so on and so forth, it's gotten appreciably worse under Common Core with draconian measures forcing children to sit for tests their parents don't want, the politicization, the bad standards, data mining, all of that. So what's interesting to see is people who maybe years ago would be neutral or just wouldn't care whether or not the federal government is involved in education. The federal government has so overstepped its bounds and come into an area of our lives that is so intimate, the raising and educating of our children, that people across the board, across the political spectrum, have just had it with the federal overreach and are fighting back. And that's where we're seeing, what I'm certainly seeing, is parents who've made a lot of sacrifices to live in public school districts that they attended, they want their children to attend, are now actually pulling their children out of public schools and either homeschooling or taking advantage of a variety of non-public school parental choice options that previously they would not necessarily have supported. So that's what I'm seeing. And I think the federal government isn't neutral anymore. It's becoming a real hindrance.
And yet these parents are still expected to pay for public education.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, so many times I get questions about what are we going to do about these homeschooling parents? And my answer is, that's one of the only areas that's working. Leave homeschooling parents alone. And along with non-public school or private school parents, I'd say rather than focus on them and, you know, try and go after them with mandates and regulations, we should be sending them, you know, thank you notes, maybe even gift baskets, because they're paying into a system that they're deriving no benefit from.
I was certainly surprised to learn, and I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn, that when the Department of Education was created in 1979, that wasn't the first time that it happened.
No. No, actually, what a lot of people don't know, and it was only brought up by one senator during the debates of the late 70s, is that our Department of Education was actually first established in 1867. And that history is very interesting because you get a very rigorous debate. One of my favorite arguments against the department. And the way it was proposed back then, it would have one director and four clerks gathering statistics. That was all very limited, nothing to be scared about. And there was just outrageous opposition to it. My favorite argument is, here's this bureaucracy that claims to have just a handful of clerks that is going to draw an outrageous amount from the public treasury, yet not educate a single child in his ABCs. So even though the Department of Education was actually enacted back in 1867, it was such a disaster that it was downgraded and defunded the following year. But here's the problem, and this is something I think we have to learn from history, otherwise we're going to repeat it, is that even though it was downgraded and defunded, and for much of the 19th and 20th centuries, it was shuffled around from one administrative office to another before it was re-elevated to a cabinet-level department again, that these sort of, let's cut it back, let's block grant, let's sort of streamline this big department, none of those plans work, because it always comes back, depending on which administration you're in, it's going to come back, it's going to continue to grow, get more intrusive. Like a weed, we have to pull this thing out by the roots and genuinely abolish it.
You focus on making sure that the effort to eliminate the Department of Education, which spends, what, about $100 billion a year?
That would just be on higher education, yes. If you include everything, it approaches and can exceed $200 billion once you include everything.
Does that include just the mandates on local schools, or is that just spending?
It would be the spending. The mandates, there's no definitive study that looks at just how much the mandates are. Various estimates of certain programs would suggest that the paperwork burden and all of that has increased, 65% just during the No Child Left Behind era from 2002 to 2009. So sadly, we don't have that kind of research. But when you look at the fact that this department started off with about $14 billion, and now once you include everything, the overhead, the programs, the federal student loans and so forth, it's grown by an order of magnitude. Yet student enrollment hasn't grown that much at any level. And we're certainly not seeing achievement improve.
So when you focus on eliminating the Department of Education, you're very careful to talk about having a strategy.
Yes.
And what should that look like?
Well, one of the things that so many decisions have been made here in D.C. at the federal level, those decisions, first and foremost, the decision-making power needs to be restored to the states. And let's be clear, I'm not arguing that it's going to be heaven on earth just because it gets back to the states. The fight's going to have to continue for parental rights and education. But the first step is just getting the programs themselves managed back at the state level, where we can more ably hold our elected and appointed officials accountable. And with that management comes the associated funding. So one of the biggest criticisms, whenever you say, oh, getting rid of the Department of Education, well, what about the children? What about all these programs that are supposed to be helping children? This plan doesn't cut a single program. It just restores management oversight and funding back to the states. And then as these programs expire, between 1 and 5 years, depending on the program, typically, it'll be the state taxpayers who decide which programs to keep and pay for at the state level with our state taxes. What we cut out is this very expensive middleman here in D.C., all the overhead, the administration, the personnel costs. Something else to keep in mind, too, is people think that, well, my goodness, the states aren't equipped to manage these programs. If you talk to various state superintendents of public instruction, they'll tell you majorities of their staff are hired just to deal with federal programs. So we already have the infrastructure in place. There is no reason to maintain this bureaucracy in D.C. We should return all of this back to the states and let these programs expire. And in terms of higher ed and lending and so forth, that should just be completely privatized.
And we've seen in the last couple of decades, the ratio of administrators to actual instructors has just exploded.
Oh, and And it's easy to see why. When you're not held accountable for your spending decisions, you're going to, no matter what choices you make, you're going to be subsidized with other people's money. Sure. I mean, that's the nature of things when you're not held accountable and you have to pay for your own choices with your own money.
So what of the concern that I hear offered, we won't know how well some students are performing in this state versus that state without some sort of federal overseer?
And, you know, you hear that a lot, and that I agree with you. That is a genuine concern. Let's look at the reality. We have never had that kind of standardization and homogenization in the United States. The closest we've come would be the nation's report card or the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is now administered through the U.S. Department of Education. It doesn't have to be. But let's take a broader view of all of these. My goodness, we can't possibly know what's going on in the states. I don't accept that argument, because one of the leading arguments behind Common Core was that we'd have one benchmark by which we could see how children in various states are doing. We already have international assessments that have been validated and, you know, put through the test themselves for more than 50 years. You want to know how students in the states are doing relative to their international peers, pick any one of the pre-existing, you know, tests that are out there. Several states already benchmark the performance of their students to these tests. We don't have to create a U.S. Department of Education. We don't need a regime to do this. We have a whole array of skills-based tests. And one thing I'd like to say about state standards, states have had standards starting since the 70s. They've had standards-based assessment. Once you start making it high stakes, and it's dollars for test scores, even though the impulse may be good, the reality is that what you don't see is behind the closed doors, state boards of education will go and lower the passing or cut scores. So we saw this was a rampant practice during the No Child Left Behind era. So it looks like, my goodness, all these children are doing better in school. All these children are passing. The reality is we just lowered the bar. So it looked like more children were passing. Those were the children we really sold out because we didn't prepare them. So the argument of having perfect knowledge of how children are doing in any state at any given time, we already have means to do this, and the paths we've pursued have been destructive, and they don't give us meaningful information.
When I was a kid, we took the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, among other things. In high school, I took the PSAT, the ACT, the SAT, and a number of other things. Is that really adequate, in your view, to get a sense of how well students are performing in these specific tasks?
Well, here's where I am on the standards debate, and I don't want to be too flip here, but we've been having this debate for decades, and frankly, I'm sick of it, because I don't trust that standards that are developed through a political process are truly rigorous academic standards. The second thing is, let's say we found the perfect test and we had perfect information about how children were doing. What good is it if parents don't have the freedom, if this information isn't actionable, so that parents can move their children to another school, can move them to another setting, if the situation children are in just isn't working for them? So this, all of this testing and all of this angst over performance measures, I don't trust the measures. Parents, in far too many cases, are left with no options. And let's look at what is really happening now. Students graduate from school. They go out into the workforce. Our economy is so strong and so powerful, where students, when they become young adults, where they're really getting an education and consequences and do your best and work hard, is really out in the private sector when they're no longer in this coddled sort of world of school. So I think I would trust, in the final analysis, I would trust parents when it comes to how well their children are doing over a politicized testing scheme. Because let's face it, with all these test results, you can't really trust that children have learned what these state politicized tests have said they have. And even if, say, the school, because a lot of states are now grading their schools and giving them letter grades. Let's say your child is going to an A school, but your child is not doing well. Your child is struggling. Should that parent be denied the right to move, you know, their children to another school, regardless of what that school's grade is? I think the measure of student performance is really our children performing basic skills and meeting certain benchmarks. And that those should be diagnostics that parents, together with their children's teachers, are working on a regular basis, not a one-point-in-time test. That tells us very little.
I've always wondered about why we grade schools, because I don't care how well a school performs in and of itself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to tell you, I've changed my mind on this. About 10 years ago, I was in favor of it. And my home state of Arizona, where I live, I thought it was a good idea because I thought this would be one more piece of information parents could use to help them make decisions that are best for their children. Well, flash forward to today, you see how the grades can be manipulated. And the bottom line is, it doesn't matter if what the school's grade is, if it's not working for an individual child, no family should be forced to stay there. And unfortunately, that's how these things are used. We're going to dole out, you know, parental choice in education based on, you know, a grade a school gets. Well, that's irrelevant if a child, for whatever reason, isn't flourishing in that setting.
Vicki Alger is author of Failure, The Federal Miseducation of America's Children. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play. Send comments and questions to cbrown@cato.org. And follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.